agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing pretty good. I don't have anything witty today, I'm afraid.
That's okay.
Long week, early morning, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, so. I totally understand. I don't either. I'm just waiting for my basement to flood in the midst of this thunderstorm we're going through. And so that'll be a fun time cleaning that up. But anyway, until that happens, we have a show to do, and I'm looking forward to it. Before we get to that, though, I want to thank some of our newest supporters. First, Donald, who made a generous contribution to the show through PayPal, and also David, who supported the show through Venmo, and he also wrote in, "Great show with the other guys, Trey and Ken, this week. As a young politics fan, it was nice to get in the weeds of economics just a bit. I love it. Keep up the great work." Thanks very much, David. And of course, as everyone knows, as a Patreon supporter, you get that second full-length episode every week. You also get ad-free versions of all our shows, as well as other things at different levels of support. To check it out, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you'd like that weekly bonus show, but you can't afford to support us financially right now, totally not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up. And if a monthly pledge is too much of a commitment, we have Patreon and Venmo as well. We're at Politics Guys. All right, so on today's show, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court's ruling on the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act, the new Juneteenth holiday, the Fed and inflation, and maybe if we have time, a Supreme Court decision on religious freedom, the Biden-Putin talks, and the House vote to repeal the 2002 Iraq authorization for use of military force. So a lot of stuff. And before,
that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
Mike.
You know, well, you know, some of it's always inevitably going to be pushed over into the midweek show, but yeah, it's always weird, Jay, to say that. Wednesday comes along and it seems like, gosh, there's not much going on. And then Thursday and Friday, things just flood right in. So that works out, I guess, really well for us. But anyway, before we get to that, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back to start the show. All right, Jay, so I thought we would start off this week with that big Supreme Court ruling on the Affordable Care Act. What do you think?
Yes. So on Thursday of this week, the Supreme Court ruled in a 7-2 decision with Justice Breyer writing the majority opinion and Justices Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett signing on to that opinion, essentially dismissing a Texas suit that had been brought against the ACA for lack of standing. Now, there were two dissents, Justices Alito and Gorsuch dissented, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I think the first thing I'd want to do, Mike, is sort of spike the football and say I think this is how I predicted this would turn out several months ago. We can go back and look at the tapes, but this was in the discussion of would Coney Barrett's nomination destroy the ACA and so forth. And I said, no. And I believe I even predicted a 7-2 ruling.
I will say what I often say when my wife reminds me of something that she said, that sounds vaguely familiar, Jay. So I'm going to, yeah, absolutely.
we can check. But so, you know, basically the majority held that there were individual plaintiffs as well as the state plaintiffs, but that they had not shown any sort of that any government action or conduct had caused or would cause any injury to them, because the tax piece of the mandate has been legislatively eliminated. So essentially it comes down to, you know, no harm, no foul. And it's one of these key things in any sort of constitutional, any sort of litigation, really, that one of the first things you have to look at is, does the party have standing, which means, do they have something at stake here? Have they been harmed or will they be harmed based on what they're alleging? And that's the basis that the court ruled on. Now, and that sort of tied into that is also the issue of severability, and we'll touch on that in a second. But the dissents took a different view, saying, yes, they had made that showing, pointing to additional costs that states incurred for administering other portions of the ACA. Again, the majority dismissed that as, well, look, those are other portions. It doesn't go to the mandate part, which has been rendered toothless by the legislature. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, I thought it was a really interesting ruling, especially the dissent. And it seems to me that there are basically three issues here. Number one, as you pointed out, do the plaintiffs have standing? Number two, if so, is the mandate that they're challenging unconstitutional? And then number three, if so, is the mandate so central to the legislation that it can't be severed from it, meaning that the entire act has to be ruled unconstitutional? And as you point out, the majority...
And my answers and the court's answers are no, yes, and no.
But of course, if you answer number one, no, then you don't go to number two or number three. So
exactly.
It's just no, and then next case. Now, yeah. Alito and Gorsuch in their dissent say yes, yes, yes to all three of those questions. My view is a little bit different. Actually, I have a yes, yes, no answer to those questions. So in a sense, I agree more with Alito.
That works.
Yeah, I agree more with Alito and Gorsuch, I guess, than I do with the seven-member majority. Though in the end, the practical result is I agree more with the majority because I believe that the act should stand. So, you know, I thought what was interesting here, maybe we could take these one at a time, the standing question, because it seems to me that actually Justice Alito had a better argument about standing. You know, his and it was a pretty blistering, I thought, dissent. He had another one, which we'll talk about, you know, later in the show, on the Wednesday show. But on the standing question, he says, that's a remarkable holding by the majority. He says, while the individual plaintiff's claim to standing raises a novel question, the states have standing for reasons that are straightforward and meritorious. The court's contrary holding is based on a fundamental distortion of our standing jurisprudence. Now, I think that's overstating it. I don't think it's a fundamental distortion, but I find the majority's argument, which I take is that, well, the cost or the harm that would give them standing isn't associated with the provision of the law that they're challenging. Well, that's true. But I think it's true but irrelevant because as they go on to argue, well, if that provision can't be severed from the law in full, then that makes it not a standing question, but a question on the merits. And so I find the majority's argument unconvincing. And I was wondering what you thought about that on the standing question.
Wow. No, so I'm actually with the majority on standing because, and maybe this is getting things a little backwards because I'm also with them on the severability question. And a lot of what the majority talks about is whether the injuries alleged by the states are fairly traceable to the mandate. And that I do agree with the majority. I don't see how you get from the increased costs, the other administrative issues, administrative burdens that are placed on the states because of the ACA, from the mandate part, because as the majority says a number of times, nobody's making you do this anymore. It's a toothless mandate. So I think the majority's right. Now I'm not saying that. What the dissent says is completely off base, but I don't see that those dots connected.
To me, they're connected. Yeah. To me, they're connected because if in fact the whole thing must be declared unconstitutional because the mandate isn't severable, then that means that the administrative cost that the states incur for having to file paperwork about ACA, and the states demonstrated that they do actually have non-trivial costs associated with that, well, absent that act, those costs would not be imposed. And so therefore, there is a harm, there is a cost. And it seems to me, I get your argument and I get the majority's argument. My feeling on this, I guess, is that in in an instance where there is some doubt, where there are good arguments on both sides, I feel like the benefit of the doubt should go toward standing for a plaintiff. And maybe you disagree with that. I don't know. But I think there are good arguments on both sides. I just find myself a little more convinced by Alito and Gorsuch's view, which is not something I expected to say.
Say, wow, you're coming around on things. You would deny healthcare to millions of people.
No. See, and that's the thing.
Actually, of course you wouldn't. To me, I guess the other piece is the severability, and that, you know, there is a presumption that if a statute can be saved by severing a portion of it, then that's what you do. It's all sort of a hypothetical kind of at this point, right? Because let's assume the mandate is unconstitutional and that there's no enforcement piece to it.
Alito says. He says, it's a hypothetical, but that's a question on the merits and not a question of standing. And I found that to be a convincing argument.
Look, he's not wrong, but I think you still lose on the merits, the severability piece. And I think you could rightfully criticize the majority at taking maybe sort of a shortcut, right?
I think they're ducking it. Yeah, I mean, I get it, how about if we move on to that second issue about the actual constitutionality of the mandate? And I was actually surprised here because I read Alito's dissent pretty closely, I think. And, you know, I found myself coming away convinced that it actually, that the mandate exceeds Congress's power. And let me just quote again from Alito's dissent. He writes, "Congress cannot supplement its powers through the two-step process of passing a tax, then removing the tax, but leaving in place a provision that is otherwise beyond its enumerated powers." And I thought, well, gosh, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
I would say amen to that, except then you fall back to the what exactly is the remedy for it, right? It becomes just sort of dead letter, sort of a vestigial tail type thing, right? It's on the books, but there's no means to enforce it. And likewise, because there's no enforcement against it, there's no real way to strike it down through the courts.
Yeah, and that maybe ties into
it's just one of these weird sort of animals out there.
Yeah. So Congress can say everyone shall do this, but and the penalty is zero for not doing that, and that's okay, but no one will ever be able to challenge it because it has because no one can suffer any kind of damages. Yeah. And see, that just seems to me to be somehow fundamentally wrong, I guess. And again, I find Alito's argument saying that, well, where is this a tax? And he goes through what the understanding of a tax is and what this means. And he says, you know, by any reasonable definition, a tax with no penalty, with no money associated, that doesn't raise any revenue, is not actually a tax. And so if that doesn't fall within Congress's taxation power, then point me to a place in the Constitution where it does. And he comes up empty on that. And, you know, I think, that's true. And it sounds like you agree with me and Alito on that, but you also don't think that anyone can challenge that for the reasons we kind of talked about
right.
previously.
Right. No, I agree with you. Again, in the hypothetical, is this outside of Congress's power? Yes. And that's why, I would have ruled that way back in, you know, Sibelius or in Burwell, the two ACA cases that preceded it.
But that was different, of course, because at that point there actually was a fee, money, and so
saying. But the other piece of this is courts are authorized to decide cases and controversies, and to me, I think that's where the majority gets it right. Is so okay? This is here. What is the case and controversy? And tell me why it isn't just hypothetical,
right?
And that's. You know, that's the thing. So, I mean, I think it's great to have, we can have that hypothetical. Is this constitutional? And I would agree with you that it's not. I think it's an extension. It was even when it was enforced, And now that it's not enforced, likewise,
yeah.
there's no constitutional power to make that proclamation. Where's the case or controversy?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And that's a reasonable argument. I think I agree that in Sibelius, the majority got it right, that when there actually was a tax and that was okay. But now I would say it's not. So we're on the same page now. We would have differed before. But moving on to that last part about severability, even if we assume and we agree that this is unconstitutional or exceeds Congress's power, you know, it seems to me this is where Alito gets it wrong. He argues, it's kind of a weird argument. He basically says, in the past, a bunch of people were saying that this is really super entwined and the mandate is incredibly important and central to this. And even though Congress zeroed it out in 2017, which I think you can reasonably say, well, if it was so central, if Congress thought it was so central, they wouldn't have zeroed it out without eliminating the entire law. But he said, well, that doesn't matter.
Exactly. The argument then was they were zeroing out to some extent to eliminate, right? That would it all fall apart if that was zeroed out?
Yeah, but at the same time, they did not end the entire Affordable Care Act. And he says, well, that's only because, as he put it, the 2017 Act, and that was the one that zeroed out the mandate penalties, would not have passed the House without the votes of the members who'd voted to scrap the ACA just a few months earlier, and the repeal of the tax or penalty, which they found particularly offensive, was their fallback option. And to me, I read that and I thought, wow, so you're doing like some congressional prognostication, and that seems a bit judicially activist and non-deferential to Congress. And I had a real problem with that, you know, saying, well, I think this is what would have happened. Well, maybe so or maybe not, but that seemed to me to be a bridge too far.
So, I would sort of argue that the other way is look, essentially, Congress did sever that provision.
Yeah.
And okay. The rest of it still kept chugging along. So kind of, you know, QED, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
We know sort of we don't even have to get into the legal analysis of does it or will it, because it's happened, right? It's happened and the act is still operating. I'm sort of on the, and again, there's a big tenet of statutory construction out there that says, look, if a statute can be saved by severability, then that's what you do.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a safeguard against judicial activism.
I mean, I wanted to ask, I thought you'd kind of come down on that because we've talked about the severability issue before. Are you surprised at what I guess I would call in certain aspects the judicial activism of Alito and Gorsuch who joined him on this, or is that something that doesn't really surprise you so much?
A little bit. I think, you know, and again, I wish I had listened to that other tape when we talked about this, because at one point I think I said, I think my words were, I think it could be unanimous or at least 7-2,
mm-hmm.
On this. And the sense I get from the Gorsuch and Alito dissent is, you know, first of all, it's a dissent, so they know they're losing, they know they've lost, but they're putting out a couple things. They do some other things in that dissent. They point out, is this consistent with how we treat standing in other cases?
Right.
You know, sort of push a little. You know, there's sort of this pushback of, look, there are other cases where we think other plaintiffs maybe haven't had the same, you know, showing of standing that we think the states have made here, but yet we haven't kicked those on standing. So there's a little, you know, taking some time to do that. I think there is a little bit of a shot at, I don't want to infer this and stir the pot, as they say. But, you know, maybe some subtle and or not so subtle criticism of Chief Justice Roberts.
Yeah.
That, you know, look, you kind of we're in this kind of goofed up position now because you took a little bit of an extraordinary step in Sibelius.
Yeah, and that was very clear. I mean, that was very clear in the dissent. Yeah. The scorn that Alito heaps upon.
I'm trying to give her the benefit of the doubt and be positive and not say Hey, they're trashing you. They're trashing you, John. But yes, if you want to phrase it that way, that you find it even more. I said subtle, and you found it to be not so subtle. But
he talks about the extraordinary lengths to which the court has gone to save this, and of course that has to refer to Roberts because absent his vote in Sebelius, that mean So and it's interesting to me that
So that's what I'm saying. I don't. My sense is the dissent is animated more out of that pushing back on. On those issues rather than substantive points of law, right? That they think the law is wrong. I think they're just kind of calling out what they see, if I could go as far as to call it hypocrisy, right? And just for the sake of calling that out.
Yeah, I think
not trying to set up, I guess, you know, Here's what the new law will be when we get more votes or something like that. Like, well, you know, that's the other thing you could typically do in dissent is saying, no, here's where they went wrong. Here's what the law ought to be. This is less that laying the groundwork and more just kind of taking some pot shots, if you will.
Yeah, I think on a certain level, you'd have to find it a little disappointing on the part of Alito and Gorsuch that they allowed their anger or their pique to sort of overwhelm, as you pointed out, sort of the clear common sense view that, well, this is severable and we know it's severable because, as you pointed out, well, look, right?
And it's been severed.
Yeah. And that's exactly the kind of judging, I think, the sort of judicial action on both the left and the right that you and I have for years called out.
Although, again, I think it's sometimes it's tough to accuse somebody of judicial activism in the dissent.
I see what you're saying. Sure. Yeah.
If you're dissenting, you're sort of by definition not a judicial activist.
Well, I would disagree with that because if the action you are calling for is activist, then it's judicial activism. It's just judicial activism.
I suppose you can make an activist argument, but yeah you're not actually
right.
There's no consequences.
Exactly.
To it.
Exactly. So, I guess, we'll have to, some will maybe look back, but I will say congratulations on your call. And of course, I feel that in the end, the decision or the practical results of the decision were correct and the Affordable Care Act lives on. And it looks to me at this point like it's on pretty solid ground at this point, at least in terms of the court, in terms of court challenges.
Probably. I think that's probably right. Unless somebody can think of, again, come up with a plaintiff who's got real standing on this, but we'll see. I wanted to bounce another issue off you though, and that's sort of the political piece of this. In that when we were going through the Kavanaugh confirmations and the Coney Barrett confirmations, Democrats, particularly Chuck Schumer, went on the floor and said, "Listen, a vote to confirm these justices is a vote to deny millions of Americans health care." And one that troubles me that there is this idea that the judges are vote in lockstep with the party that nominated them, or that we're appointing judges for policy purposes. But that didn't pan out.
Nope. No, and I think that's fair to point out. And I too am troubled, and both on the left and the right, we've seen it more on the left, just because it's been conservative nominations to the Supreme Court for a while. But yeah, I think that sort of hyperbole. We don't often know. We can have some pretty good ideas on certain issues how nominees to the court will decide. But I think, you know, both this case, and we'll get to it either later on in the show or the Wednesday case, I think especially in the religious freedom issue on that case where a number of people expected Justice Barrett, I think in particular, to vote in one way, and she didn't. So right now, at least in terms of this particular term of the court, the worst fears of the left so far have clearly not been realized. And, you know, to me, of course, that's a relief.
Yeah, no, to me, it's less of a not so much a relief. It's just sort of what I expected.
Yeah.
And what you would hope for. Right. And look, again, you don't always get judges ruling the way you'd like. But I think the criticism that these nominees were extreme and were being put on for solely, you know, policy reasons to reverse legislative policy. It just is not the case. And I think if you were, I'd hope if you were, you know, one of these people who wore a Handmaid's Tale outfit to a confirmation hearing, you're feeling maybe a little silly now.
Well, but, I don't think so. I don't think so.
That may have sailed, but.
No, I don't think so, because we still, I mean, in terms of the magnitude of the cases the court took up in this term, a little, I mean, not as much as some things that are coming up in the future. And, you know, like for instance, the abortion challenges. And so I think that, as you jokingly put it, the people with the Handmaid's Tale, you know, costumes or what have you, you know, let's wait and see what they do with those abortion challenges. And, I hope you're right, certainly. But we'll, it remains to be seen. I think next term, I think, is going to be a much more significant term for a number of reasons, but we'll see about that.
All right.
Okay. Before we move on to our next door, we're just going to take a quick break and we will be right back. Everyone deserves nice things, but with all the markups in traditional luxury retail, high quality goods can be awfully expensive. Quince is different. They're a one-stop shop for essential products with low design costs. They've got tees, hoodies, loungewear, pants and shorts, blouses, dresses, skirts. I mean, unless you're a nudist, they've got something for you. And, you know, even if you are clothing optional, they've got home accessories, bedding, bath, decor, all sorts of good stuff. Quince finds the best factories and only partners with those committed to the highest production standards, fair wages, safety, and sustainability, which is particularly a big deal to me. And because Quince is shipping directly to you with no agents, stores, or other middlemen, you get great 100% factory-direct prices on everything. I mean, I've been desperately in need of some new t-shirts, and I was really impressed by the price and quality of their organic Pima cotton selection. And my bath towels, honestly, are looking pretty ratty, too. So Quince's great prices on high-quality Turkish bath towels, they really caught my eye. Quality shouldn't be a luxury. You deserve it. So try Quince today. Get free shipping and 365-day free returns by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. Many of their collections sell out immediately, so don't wait. You can save hundreds of dollars on clothing and accessories by going to onequince.com/politicsguys. That's onequince.com/politicsguys. So happy Juneteenth, Jay. We are
We have a new federal holiday.
Yeah, we are recording this actually on the official Juneteenth day, the 19th of June. And so I thought this would be, of course, a very opportune day to talk about this, right?
Yeah. So this, and I'll tell you, Mike, Juneteenth sort of snuck up on us this year in that it became a holiday yesterday Thursday afternoon, I should say. It was a bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate. It passed the Senate unanimously, and then quickly moved to the House, where it passed 415-14, and was immediately signed into law by President Biden. Which, Mike, I'll also tell you, it's a little bit weird when you have things to do in court on that are scheduled for Friday, and then on the Thursday night before that Friday, that next day becomes a federal holiday all of a sudden.
I bet
it can generate some confusion. The 14 who voted against it, Senator Cornyn described one of them as the criticism as being sort of kooky. And the criticisms, the votes against, there were some, General Goldberg pointed, to one, member, and I'm missing his name right now in Congress, who voted against it based on the title of the bill. So it was called the Juneteenth Independence Day something holiday.
Right, that somehow people would confuse this with
it's somehow seeking to conflate or take away from that actual Independence Day. And look, I think he's right on the merits, right? That the official title would better have been called Emancipation Day or Freedom Day or something like that.
But as he pointed out in the article, and it was a funny article when he talked about, well, yeah, if you think about that, who's going to call it anything but Juneteenth? Exactly. I mean, it's not like we call Labor Day the official name of Labor's holiday. And there was a whole,
Well, yeah, Thanksgiving is something, it was the Thanksgiving to our beneficent God for the blood of God.
Right, exactly,
in
yeah.
Something like that is the official title of the holiday. And as it, to me, I'm a big believer in this is sort of the Burkean traditional piece, right? I mean, the federal government observes Independence Day. Real Americans celebrate the 4th of July.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you don't, if people don't get what I mean by that, then I guess they never will. But to me, that you know, look, I think that may have been a fair criticism, a fair thing to quibble over. But probably, like Jonah says, I don't see that would be something that would vote against it.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of you know, one of the other the representative who Corwin
right, Senator Corwin, who that he okay. was the one who called that.
There was a Ohio former Ohio speaker minority leader named Corbin, and I keep every time I try to say it, that's what comes out. That, you know, he voted against it on the basis of this is part of just a woke movement type thing. And I don't think that's the case. And quite honestly, I could make the very strong conservative case, as many have, that Juneteenth is very much a holiday we should celebrate. And in fact, it's almost antithetical in a lot of ways to critical race theory and wokeism,
which is what which is what Rosedale, the guy who voted that comment that Cornyn called kooky, he said, let's call an ace, and of course he meant what he wanted to say was, but he didn't say
the other thing. Yes.
Right, this is an effort by the left to create a day out of whole cloth to celebrate identity politics as part of its larger efforts to make critical race theory the reigning ideology of our country. And that's when Texas Republican John Cornyn said just kooky. And you know, you may have issues with critical race theory. I know you do, but conflating those two things is just not correct.
Well, and I would make the argument now that when Biden's signing statement, he actually said some things which I think were in a weird sort of disparity. I guess the question is Juneteenth a celebratory day or it is a day of mourning? Biden seemed to take the latter position, right? Whereas I think properly understood, Juneteenth should be treated as a celebratory affair, in that this is the day that you know we ended slavery, and by we I mean the American people, right? Everybody. This is not a pigeonholed ethnic group or racial group holiday. It's something that the whole country can and ought to celebrate.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm actually a fan of this. Now, again, I've got my traditional, I'd say, conservative curmudgeonly, geez, do we need another federal holiday? Sort of thing. That's still in the background. Right?
Well, let's talk about that, because I wanted to talk about that.
I'd gladly would trade Juneteenth for many of several other federal holidays.
So. I wanted to talk about that because Ron Johnson, the Wisconsin Republican senator, basically he decided not to object to the unanimous consent of this in the Senate, but he said, you know, this is another paid holiday for 2 million federal employees at a cost of $600 million per year. And that's kind of along the lines of maybe some of your concerns. And my initial reaction to that was, well, my gosh, when you compare U.S. workers just in general to workers pretty much anywhere in rich countries in the world, we get so many fewer paid holidays. U.S. employees overall average around 10 paid holidays per year, compared to, according to the OECD, 37 in the UK, 36 in Spain and France, 30 in Germany. Even Mexico has more. They have 13. Canada has 19. So, I mean, it seems to me a few more paid holidays is actually a good thing, I would think. That maybe brings us more in the line with what I would consider to be reasonableness.
Yeah, I think you can. That to me, that's one of those arguments that's not a hill I'd die on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I get that.
I think there is always some concern that when you start adding, and this is the first new federal holiday that's been added in 40 years. But I think there is always that sort of creeping sort of slippery slope type thing, right? Where, well, if we Juneteenth, you know, then there will be another. And look, there are some of these holidays that popped up. I mean, Columbus Day being one of chief among them, right? I mean, there was heavily lobbied by folks in the Italian American community to recognize Christopher Columbus and so forth. And look where that's gotten us now.
Well, what do you? Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that since you bring it up. What do you think about the argument for renaming Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day, or kind of changing that? What's your thinking on that?
I think that makes it even worse, if you will.
Okay.
But I mean, let me go up and for all the reasons why I think Juneteenth is good, that's bad. And so, for example, what we're talking about on Juneteenth is celebrating an actual event, a definite thing that happened in time. And we can look at the facts of what happened and have a conversation about it. And again, there's a lot to celebrate there. And that story necessarily involves Abraham Lincoln and involves his statements at the Gettysburg Address that, you know, we'll move forth in a new birth of freedom, right? That's, you know, there. It is sort of like a second founding, second 4th of July. That's, you know, so many you know, scholars, historians have referred to the end of the Lincoln presidency and the post-Civil War amendments as sort of the second founding. So I think that is important stuff. And I think it's important when you have holidays that are tied to an actual historical event, as opposed to, let's say, Martin Luther King Day, which is set aside to, well, it honors a man who was a flawed man. And the more we find out, he may have been seriously flawed, a man, but also certain ideas that he promoted. And again, some of those ideas are wonderful, but there was other stuff that is not so wonderful.
Well, I would disagree with you. Let me just jump in and say that what you call flaws, I think a lot of folks, especially on the left, would call actually would see exactly the other way. I think it's clear that history has shown that.
Talking about,
I know what you're talking about. There's this sort of sanitized version of MLK that for popular consumption, but he actually turned out to be, you know, in many ways considerably more radical than the standard story. And a lot of us on the left say, like, well, yeah, and that's a good thing, and we're happy we can celebrate that. I can understand where a lot of people on the right would see those as flaws, but
I put that in that second category of ideas that I may disagree with. By flaws, I mean seriously character flaws. Some of the research that came out before about being present at rapes, cheating on his wife serially. There were a lot of, if the Me Too movement had been active at that time, there may well have been some. I don't know. I don't know how it would have.
Well, that means, but that sounds a little hypocritical of you.
That's what I'm referring to, not ideological predilections.
Well, I wonder if that's a little hypocritical of you, and maybe it's not. But it seems to me that you have criticized the Me Too movement and sort of historical revisionism, and so now are you saying that, well, we shouldn't celebrate Martin Luther King for his leadership, his unquestionably critical leadership of the unquestionably, I would say, good civil rights movement in this country because of some character flaws? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying I like holidays better that commemorate actual events rather than the holidays that are intended to honor a particular person. for the very reason that people are flawed.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
The holiday then becomes not so much an observation of something that happened, but then a litmus test on you know, this person and reading all these different things into them. And that's why I'm saying I prefer Juneteenth to or Columbus Day same reason.
But I think that the reason why, you know, it's MLK Day is that he is sort of the focus of that movement. In other words, there wasn't single day, a single event, but I think most Americans now recognize the civil rights movement in this country as a great moral good. There's just not a specific date, and sure. I think it's something that absolutely should be celebrated. And so we pick out this clearly the leading figure in this movement, and use him as a way to celebrate. So I don't see MLK Day being a celebration of Martin Luther King specifically, but more of the civil rights movement.
His name on it, and they have birthday. So
and President's Day is technically still, you know, George Washington's birthday kind of thing. But I think those are the only two that are directly linked to a person's name and is still federal holiday sort of thing. But yeah, I have less of a problem with it than you do. But
I think you're misunderstanding me. I'm not saying. I have a problem with it. I'm saying if we're naming holidays, I think the Juneteenth type holiday is far superior.
Yeah, but it's a different thing. I'm saying we're celebrating something different with Juneteenth than we are when we celebrate MLK Day.
Right. That's my point.
But I think we should celebrate the civil rights movement at least once a year.
Sure.
So what would you?
I think your question was why is Juneteenth better than
I don't think it's better. I see what you're saying.
We talked about Columbus. Well, no, listen, what you said, Columbus Day, can we change it to Indigenous Peoples Day? And I said, well, look, I'm not crazy about the holidays that are based solely on people.
Sure, I get what you're saying.
And then I think moving Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, I think that makes it even more amorphous, right? I guess that's what I'm sort of arguing is I think holidays ought to be based on or are better based on specific events and things that happened that we commemorate rather than things that are sort of more wishy-washy, whether that be a person, a people, or just vague ideas.
Right. Which is not to say that you necessarily would, you know, if you were in Congress, would vote to repeal the federal holiday for Columbus Day or MLK Day. Right. No. Gotcha. I see what you're saying. What do you think about, and there's some suggestion, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, I think, about making Election Day a federal holiday?
I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, me too, obviously. So, yeah.
You know, we would start going down that track of, well, what, only one day for Election Day? Come on. You can't expect me to vote just in one day. I would expect extended to a week and so forth. But no, I don't have any objection to that. And I think it might be a good patriotic sort of signaling, right? Again, I'm big on, I've spouted this and people have even made fun of me before, but because I think everyone voting on Election Day is something good because it is that sort of marker of national unity. Just like, you know, the 4th of July, where we can say, hey, this was the day that they signed the Declaration of Independence. Independence was actually declared, as I'm sure you know, Mike, on July 2nd. Mm-hmm. But they just didn't actually have the document ready to sign until the 4th. But the resolution passed on the
2nd. The Kinko's was closed. Yeah, it was the whole thing. Yeah,
exactly. But it's like that. It's here is something that's actually happening on this day that we're getting together to celebrate something that the entire country can celebrate. Right. It is unifying.
And we can definitely say that the entire country can and should celebrate the fact that we ended slavery. And we can that June 19th is, I think, the best, the most fitting day to commemorate that.
Yeah, no, I've heard arguments, and I think if you're going to be technically, legally you know, technical about this, you could say, well, the day the 13th yeah. Amendment was ratified yeah. might be a better day. But I don't think so. I don't think it has the same, you know, again, because slavery at that point had already been eliminated. It hadn't been officially eradicated constitutionally for all time, but.
And that would be creating something out of whole cloth. I mean, in a sense, because there already is at least some tradition
right.
around Juneteenth.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, as a Burkean, you would like that a little bit better, I think.
Maybe that's the best way that I can describe this, right? That holidays like the 4th of July and Juneteenth, and to some extent, I suppose you could say, Veterans Day, which was originally Armistice Day, Thanksgiving. Those are the more Burkean pre-existing holidays, right? That the federal government just sort of recognizes, as opposed to the federal government saying, "Hey, let's have a holiday here."
Right. But yeah, I see what you're saying, but I also think there is something to be said for taking a pause to commemorate things that are important in our history, even though they don't have that sort of tradition behind them, because they can't, of course, because
sure.
you can't celebrate Juneteenth before, you know, the 1860s, obviously, right? So, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah. All right, well, I guess we largely agree on that. And before we get to something we might have a little bit more disagreement on, and that is the Fed and interest rates, we're going to take a final quick break, and we will be right back. Okay, Jay, so how about if we talk about the latest statements by the Federal Reserve and where we think things are going, whether or not we agree with Powell and Yellen and company on all this stuff?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, you and I have joked, sort of, I believe it was Justice Kagan who had said, we're all textualists now, that we're all modern monetarists now. But maybe less so. So the Fed met earlier this week, and Fed Chairman Jerome Powell announced that he expected signaled that the Fed may raise interest rates by late 2023. This is sooner than they had anticipated or predicted at their March meeting. Now, then, following up on that, the Fed president from St. Louis made a statement Friday or Thursday night, saying that he thought it would be more late 2022 when the Fed would or should move to raise interest rates. Now, in both cases, it sort of roiled the markets, particularly the Dow, which dropped substantially, most substantially on Friday. So the issue, of course, that comes up, that what the Fed is trying to guard against is inflation. The CSI, the CPI, Consumer Price Index, is up from May, was up 5% over the prior year, which is a significant jump. And if you look at inflation just by, you know, quarterly and then annualize it, it's even bigger. Now, I don't know whether those annualizing it, you know, really holds out. That remains to be seen. But the Fed's stated goal is they want to have 2% inflation with essentially maximum sustained employment. So my take on this is I have always been reluctantly a modern monetarist. I was sort of dragged into it, right? Like a whole lot of people were last year. So I think it's good that the Fed is signaling that it's going to keep an eye and will hold the reins on inflation, because I think there is some scariness out there, just on the basis that, look, the recession we're coming out of this time is different than your typical recession, and it's different in two ways. One, it wasn't caused by the typical business cycle type of recession, right? It was caused by this really weird outside influence and the government's response to it, and it's something that can turn around much quicker because of that. The second reason that it's so much different and weird is that there is this unprecedented government spending and push against it that you've never seen in any other recession. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be very concerned about inflation, and I'm glad that the Fed is eyeing this. I would hope they would eye it maybe even a little stronger than they are now.
So it sounds to me like you feel that the Fed is acting with reasonable prudence here, although you might like to see a little bit stronger signal that they're considering raising interest rates more or sooner. Is that a fair
right.
character?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's you know, I thought that's probably where you would come down. Now, if we were talking to Trey, I can just see Trey, if he's hearing this, just shaking his head, because Trey's the one of all our hosts who kind of is our inflation hawk, I guess you could say. And I get those arguments. And there are plenty of people who, like Trey, believe that the Fed should be doing more. You know, there's that famous quote from former Fed chair William Chesney McMartin, I think it is, who said, "Like, the job of the Fed is to take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going." And that's always a tough thing to judge, right? Because there's a lag on both sides, meaning that yeah. the data that the Fed has to work with in making these decisions is a snapshot of the past, not the present. And also, it takes time for any action the Fed makes to reach its full impact. So it is difficult to judge, but I tend to agree with Yellen, with Powell, that, as you pointed out, that there are a lot of these factors that are very specific to the incredibly unusual circumstances of the last year. And there's much more reason to believe than not that this is going to be sort of a temporary minor spike in inflation and not something that's going to be permanent. So therefore, you don't want to jump in, raise interest rates, and kind of slow down the recovery to deal with that.
Yeah, but again, I would be a stronger inflation hawk than I think Powell or yeah. Yellen would be. Again, I'm not a trained economist, but you know, sort of again the you know, the smartest people in the country have gotten us into other big monetary problems. So I mean, the people who were managing the Fed during the 1970s, I'm sure, were much smarter and better educated than me. But there we were. I think actually the concern that, you know, something that's again a weird thing about inflation is it can be that crazy cycle that feeds upon itself. And I think that's the concern, is you need to hit it early so that you don't get that increasingly ramped up gusts, if that makes any
yeah.
sense.
No,
right?
And
to me, that's why the Yellen problem is probably the bigger one, is that the more money the government pumps into the economy, the more fuel there is for inflation. So I think it's you know, one, let's slow down the spending, and two, let's have the Fed start applying the brakes gradually.
Yeah, and Trey and I have kind of gone back and forth on this, because, like I said, he takes your position to, I think, an even higher degree. And you know, I point out that, well, we've been waiting, because you of course know that even since
yeah.
the spending from the in
since
response
2008,
yeah.
we were figuring there was going to be a spike, yeah,
and there was sort of this Chicken Little-ish sort of thing from the classical economists, and you know, there's going to be massive inflation just right around the corner, and well, it's been over a decade and we haven't seen it. It's left a lot of people scratching their heads. In fact, the Fed is, you know, often said, we don't understand why there isn't more. It seems kind of weird. But and so I guess I'm a little more hesitant to jump to any sort of conclusions. And I think that this sort of action of saying, hey, yes, the brakes will get pumped at some point here in the foreseeable future, seems to me to be a pretty good approach to these things. And so I think Powell's right on track with this. I'm sure we both hope that I'm right and that Powell's right on this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, Jay, I think we have a little more time. Why don't we, I think it would be nice to kind of fit in that second Supreme Court, the big Supreme Court case, which is weird to say because you generally don't think of a unanimous opinion as a big deal, but it was just a big deal for other reasons, I suppose, right?
Exactly. The Supreme Court ruled in a unanimous 9-0 decision on Thursday that the city of Philadelphia can't tell a foster care agency to violate its faith as a condition of obtaining a city contract. Justice Alito, however, wrote a sort of blistering 77. He has a busy week. 77-page concurrence indicating that yes, while the court gets it right, the courts should do much more to safeguard religious liberty, and that this decision may not do that. In fact, would not do that. So this was Fulton versus Philadelphia, and the case turned on a Catholic Church social services, which has operated under a city contract for 50 years. And what the Catholic Church would do was help assist in placing children with foster families. Now, the church abided by its teachings and believed that it would not place children with a gay couple. Now, significantly in this case, the facts showed that no gay couple had ever asked. And to the extent that there were ever any issues, the CSS, the Catholic Social Services, simply referred people out to many of the 20-some other placement agencies that could do this. So those the facts were sort of peculiar in that sense. But this got out in the newspaper that the church's hypothetical position, at least, was it wouldn't place people with a gay couple. And so the city sued and tried to shut them down. They lost the first couple rounds, but won at the Supreme Court on the sense that this is a generally applicable law, which typically can mean you don't get a religious exemption. But if the generally applicable law allows for discretionary exceptions, which this one did, then it's not really generally applicable.
Right.
If you follow me. Yep. I don't know if I explained
that. No, yeah, because well if it can't be generally applicable if there's exceptions, because that sort of is the opposite of generally.
This sort of said it's generally applicable unless we say it's not.
Yeah.
So the court said, look, on that basis, then there is essentially a What the city of Philadelphia did was improperly deny the Catholic social services an exemption.
Right, because they said essentially that the since it's not generally applicable, then that means that the court applies strict scrutiny here, and that means that's the highest standard of review. And so the state here has to show that there's not only a compelling governmental interest in doing what they're doing, but also that the way they're achieving it is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. And in this instance, okay, maybe there's such an interest, but the court found that giving Catholic social services an exemption would probably increase the number of children finding foster families, which furthers the state's interest. And secondly, that the governmental interest in non-discrimination isn't sufficient to deny Catholic social services its free exercise-based waiver that they think it should basically get. And it seems to me that there's a reason why this was a unanimous opinion, right? Even the court's three liberals signed on to this. But the interesting thing to me was just the bile, the anger in the dissent from Alito. And it was a long dissent, 77 pages was just, concurrence, just scathing. Yeah. It felt like a dissent, didn't it? When he said, the majority's decision might as well be written on the dissolving paper sold in magic shops. I had a Scalia flashback, and wow, he was not a happy guy. And the reason he was not a happy guy is because what I think a lot of conservatives were hoping, and certainly what Catholic Social Services was hoping, was that this would be an opportunity for the court to revisit their decision in Employment Division versus Smith, in which they created that, or that where that precedent was set of the fact that generally applicable laws that happen to apply to religious and non-religious groups are okay. I don't violate the free exercise clause. And that's what Alito was arguing should be considered. And here to me is where I think Alito, he was right about sort of the evanescence of the ruling, because Philadelphia can just rewrite its law to make it generally applicable. And that just
they can just say no exceptions. Yeah. And at that point, then it's a different case, right?
Yeah.
I think there's still a good argument that it violates the First Amendment, even if they do that, particularly in light of this ruling, right? If it looks like very much the intent is to discriminate against a religious entity, then there's that. So to some extent, I think Alito's concerns there might be a little overblown.
Onto the issue of, you know, of Smith. Now, Alito argues that going on to that issue, saying that, well, you know, the free exercise clause is not just some non-discrimination clause, but it seems to me that he misreads in a weird way the First Amendment, at least the religion provisions, because when you take the free exercise clause in conjunction with the establishment clause, it seems to me that the decision in Smith actually really walks this line in a good way. And that was a decision in which Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion, in which he said, respondents urge us to hold quite simply that when otherwise prohibitable conduct is accompanied by religious convictions, not only the convictions, but the conduct itself must be free from governmental regulation. We have never held that and decline to do so now. And I read that and I think, yeah. And Alito is saying, well, no. And I think Scalia is right on this and Alito's wrong.
Wow. That's really a thin line there, where you're saying Scalia's right. Now, I think you can. Part of this always again turns on the case that's before the court.
Sure.
And for that reason, I'm going to sort of take the same position that I did when we were talking about the healthcare case. Is that in this instance, while I would say the dissent in the ACA case was more just to call out other decisions for hypocrisy or to sort of indicate that, hey, this is what happens when we try to bend over backwards to save a statute that perhaps shouldn't have been saved. These are the weird results we get. This, to me, is much more of the setting up for the next case, right? This is the more substantive dissent. At 77 pages, how could it not be substantive?
Yeah. It's
very much an argument that we need to take up a stronger defense of religious practice. And interestingly, it was Justice Alito. He was the keynote speaker at the Federal Society meeting last year. And this was really one of the topics he hit on, was that free exercise of religion has become in many ways a disfavored right. It's not surprising. And I think this looks like to be laying the groundwork for something else. But
on that, Jay, I should say that it seems to me that there are at least four votes to overturn or potentially overturn that ruling in Smith, because Justice Barrett, even though she didn't sign on to the dissent or that concurrence, she also wrote separately, essentially arguing that we should at least the court should at least reconsider Smith, though not in this instance. And so,
right, because this case just doesn't present the right facts to do so.
Yeah,
yeah, but, and that's what I mean. I think that's correct. I don't think this case does, but what Alito's doing is setting it up for Coney Barrett sort of with the assist of you know, getting ready to when the right case does come along with the right set of facts. Yeah.
But what do you think, Jay, the larger question, did Scalia and the majority get it wrong in 1990 in Smith?
Wow, you're asking me to say did Scalia get it wrong?
Yeah, I put it that way specifically. You know, absolutely, absolutely.
That's a tough one. I would say every case has to be decided on its facts.
Oh, so that's a lawyerly response. Really, good job,
I think
Jay.
You, right then, but different facts, and I think you could make a strong case that Smith ought to be supplemented, perhaps, or some nuance added.
Well, let me ask you. Let me rephrase.
That are presented.
Allow me to rephrase. Would you agree? And I will quote part of that Scalia quote that when otherwise prohibitable
confirmation hearing. Geez.
Yeah, I know. When otherwise prohibitable conduct is accompanied by religious convictions, not only the convictions but the conduct itself must be free from governmental regulation. And in response to that, Scalia says, "Well, no, that's not right." And you're not saying that that is correct.
I'm not saying that is correct. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So I would be disagreeing with Scalia on that. Yeah. So for example, there's a fun case out of, I believe it's out of Hawaii that deals with animal sacrifice. Where the court says, look, that you can, it's the statute actually banning this was, overbroad, because it was only, really, or under-inclusive, because it was only enforced against animal sacrifice practitioners and not against people who own slaughterhouses or other people who would be disposing of animal wastes, animal carcasses. So I guess, you know, again, I don't know. The gist is that and Scalia's been strong in this for a while. Also, the case that prompted the Religious Freedom Act.
Religious Freedom Restoration Act,
peyote.
Right? Yeah.
Where Scalia said, look, this can be your religion. That's fine. You can believe what you want, but here's certain things that you can't do. So again, in this case, it's a little weird in that the CSS was never actually refused to place somebody.
Right.
And I think that's maybe presents a different factual sort of pattern of, you know, is there conduct that is necessarily going with the conscience element of it? I suppose there is, but it's harder to point to, right? When you can't have it, when it hasn't actually happened yet.
Yeah. You know, one thing that struck me when I was thinking about this decision is that when we talk about religion cases and the First Amendment, it seems to me that there's an analogy here in a weird way with the Second Amendment. What I mean by that is that oftentimes I think people, particularly on the left, when we think about
religion, like both.
Well, but no, when we think about religion cases and these issues on the left, oftentimes we tend to focus on the Establishment Clause, right? As opposed to the Free Exercise Clause. But of course, you can't, they're conjoined, right? You can't just separate them. You have to consider them as a unit in a sense. At the same way, when we're talking about the Second Amendment, those of us on the left will say, well, but this thing about the well-regulated militia, right? What's that? And then people on the right saying, just focusing on the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And again, these are things that were written as part of an integrated whole. And I think oftentimes what people on both sides do is not consider them as part of that whole.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah, well, thank you.
And if you also figure that, again, the First Amendment was patterned on Jefferson's Bill of Rights in the Virginia Constitution, the Virginia Religious Liberties, and the context in which the framers were operating, right? I mean, it's all ancient history to us now, but to them, it wasn't. You know, they're coming off just, you know, 100 years, 150 years ago, where there were some pretty significant religiously animated wars, including a civil war that went on in England. And there was significant religious persecution during that time. And the reason that, you know, so many people fled the colonies in the first place was to flee from one set of persecutors or the other. And that was sort of, we sort of ended up with this, you know, funny mix because of that, right? I mean, the Puritans got out because they were being persecuted, and then the when the Puritans took over, the Catholics were being persecuted, so they took off and headed for Maryland, and nobody liked the Quakers, and you know, so that this religious pluralism is something that would have been very familiar to the founders, and something very important to them, because they would listen. People risked their lives, left their homeland, in order to be able to practice their religion freely. And then the second piece that Jefferson had objected to, that goes more to the Establishment Clause, was people in Virginia were being forced to pay taxes to support the Church of England. And by the time we got into the 1760s and the 1770s, you know, the Church of England was essentially also the government of England, the state. So there was that argument that, listen, we shouldn't be compelled to essentially pay the salaries of British clergymen in the States. So, I agree. Yeah, you have to look at the whole piece of it. And I think there will be you know, more religious liberty in terms of free expression cases that come up in the next couple years. I mean, similar to like a Masterpiece Cake, it may even be another Masterpiece Cake case that's going to get to the merits of the religious expression, as opposed to, you know, again, Masterpiece kind of Cake kind one kind of punted a little bit and didn't reach the merits. But
and this court, I think, would be a little less likely to do that, for better or for worse, depending on kind of how the outcome would be, I think. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Well, I think that about does it for this week's show. But just a quick update to folks. I'm sure, Jay, you remember that a while ago I mentioned our goal to get 5% of our listeners to support us on Patreon. And we were so close. I looked one day and I was like, wow, we're almost there, which is amazing for a podcast. It really shows how great and supportive our listener base is. And we just need, well, not that many more. I think last time I checked, 20 new supporters. If we get that, we will be at that 5% goal. And I made a promise. I said if we get there by the end of this month, not all of our supporters will get not one, not two, but three extra bonus episodes with topics chosen by our Patreon supporters. So if you've been listening for a while, but you haven't quite yet gotten to that point of supporting us, this would be a great time, because you'll get some, everyone will get some free stuff, and that will be really kind of cool, I think. So anyway, if you're interested in doing that, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. But also, if you are a supporter, we have our bonus show that Jay and I will be recording in just a minute here that comes out on Wednesday mornings. We'll be talking about the Biden-Putin talks, the House repealing the 2002 Iraq authorization for use of military force, and we'll be taking some listener questions responding to those. And Patreon supporters get that. Other stuff at various levels of support. Again, that's patreon.com/politicsguys to check all of that out. And remember, if you want that, but you're just not in the place where you can support the show financially, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. Come, and I will get that all set up for you. Finally, if you haven't yet subscribed to the show or left a rating or review, that really does help us out. So please, please do that. We really would appreciate if you just take a minute to do that. Finally, if you just want to get in touch with us for any random reason, our address is mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find the links to those in our show notes. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.